You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, good day from Germany. This is Golf Show. This Golf Show episode is entirely in English. Out of our last 15 shows, only two were in English. Not something we had planned. It just kind of happens when you chase stories. As a result, we lost a bunch of international listeners, primarily in our second biggest market in the United States. But tonight we're going to get them all back and more with one big bang. But then again, this podcast is not about us. It's about our guests. It's about our audience, and it's about the game of golf. The value of a podcast can certainly not be measured by how many downloads or streams you get, just like an artist's value cannot be measured by how many records he sells. We have joining us today the one, the only Miss Dottie Pepper, a woman of many firsts. She played on the very first American Solheim Cup team in 1990, which was captained by Kathy Whitworth. Before that, though, she somehow played her way onto the boys' golf team at her high school in Saratoga Springs. I'm going to need to hear that story. She was the first female announcer reporting from the Masters, and the first walking reporter at Augusta, period. She's won 17 times on the LPGA Tour, including two majors, topping the $6 million mark in earnings. And she drives an Audi RS7, but more importantly, an Italian job style, souped up Mini Cooper is parked in her garage. She just wrote a very special book called Letters to a Future Champion. But before that book, she co-authored a children's book with Scott Fuller called Bogey Tees Off. And it's a story of a range ball whose ambition it is to make it to the PGA Tour. I ordered the book last week for my daughter, who's 8. It didn't come today, so I don't have it in front of me, but it's coming. I can't wait to read that. The LPGA website today lists her hobbies as gardening, music, sports cars, downhill skiing, and wine collecting, which makes the crush I once had on Dottie Macri so much more valid. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that today is her first appearance on a German podcast. Dottie, Mark and I are honored to have you on our show. Thank you for accepting our invitation and welcome to Radio Golf Show.
Oh, thank you both. As I sit here with my miniature German Schnauzer on my lap, he has on cue settled in for a 1 hour nap. So here we go. But right. I will say, my garage has gotten bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Fuller. It hasn't gotten bigger. It's gotten fuller.
Okay.
So I did something really crazy. We'll go back to Sunningdale in 1996 at a pre-Solheim Cup gathering hosted by Judy Rankin. She adored Sunningdale, and the people there adored her. Well, we finished playing golf, and Sean Connery was on site that day with, of course, an Aston Martin. And this motorhead had to go check it out. So I've been looking for just the right Aston Martin since 1996, and it finally found its way. So
So is it a vintage Aston Martin?
It's a 2012 Vantage 6-speed. I don't know. This guy that had it in Florida babied the heck out of it. I promise I'm going to keep it very, very clean, but I'm going to drive it like it's supposed to be driven. So yesterday was the virgin Virgin trip. And we're going to do it again today because there's no rain in the forecast.
It's a scoop.
Yeah, there's a scoop.
There's definitely a scoop. Aston Martin. Oh, baby. Well, we got a lot of stuff to talk about. Not only your book, but and your career as a player and as an announcer. Maybe we can start there, because I remember watching you when you first started, when I first moved to the States in the early 80s and then in the late 80s on TV. I remember watching you, and you had this, I don't know, it reminded me of what Raymond Floyd had on the PGA Tour. This, I don't know, it's something that the winners have. And I read somewhere that your father instilled the values in you that you needed to achieve your goals. What kind of values were that?
Well, he was, my father played a little bit of Major League professional, or Major League Baseball, and was signed by the Detroit Tigers the day he graduated from American High School here in Saratoga Springs. But as things, you know, as one of the best players in the game, made the cover of Sports Illustrated with Johnny Bench as one of the best rookies in March of 1968. Tigers go on to win the series that fall. Things didn't turn out as it planned. So part of my dad's, I wouldn't say harping, but his education for me was to have a plan B, because he really didn't have a plan B. So that plan B for me was to have an education, which I ended up getting at Furman. But my dad still is completely competitive at 79 years old. Has just been handed two more divisions at his company to get back on track. So I guess I'm in for the long haul, but he set a pretty good foundation for goal setting and getting things done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then somehow you started off by playing in Saratoga. You're from Saratoga Springs. I know I've driven from the city up to 87 to
sure.
What's that exit? Pottersville, I think. I sent three kids to summer camp.
Yeah, Pottersville, I think, is exit 28 or 29, because Lake Placid's 30. Yes,
right. A little bit. It's up there. It's beautiful, and with all the lakes and beautiful, but. You wanted to play golf in, I guess it was high school, and they didn't have a girls team. So you somehow, I don't know what you had to do. It sounded like a big project that you were able to and allowed to play on the boys team.
We had to petition the state of New York, the Public High School Athletic Association, to allow girls to play on boys team. I had to pass a special physical, calisthenics from A to Z. And fortunately, I had an athletic director at Saratoga High School that I think for the very end of, well, certainly through my uncle's time, was the athletic director. So he had members of the family, of my family, in school, and kind of knew our history, knew that I could handle it. And sadly, they just within the last 4 years have put together a girls golf team at Saratoga Springs High School. But it was pretty cool to have gotten the call from the athletic director when they did get that done, because there's an award in my name every year given at the year-end sports banquet in the spring, to say, we need to go shopping again because we have to have an equivalent award for the girls. So that was a pretty cool phone call to get.
Can I just delve into that? That means that the team is only 4 years old at school. So it took from the 80s when you
Correct.
Were there up until now. So we're talking about plus minus 40 years to build, you know, to even get enough girls interested in the sport to set up a girls team.
In our area, yes. Now, there were school districts across the state that had enough girls to play and to play a state championship, but we did not in this area. And sadly, one of the athletic directors in the area, when we were really lobbying and doing the work to get this to fruition, beginning 6 years ago, said, well, it's partly your fault because you didn't need girls to compete against. And I said, that's the lamest thing I've ever heard in my life. That's such a cop out. But it's true. We've got a young girl that takes her lessons here in Saratoga Springs and plays golf in this section of public high school in New York that is going to be a rock star.
There you go. And you won, I think you won the New York State Amateur while you were in high school, right?
I was. I was as a 15-year-old, yes.
That's pretty incredible.
So how sorry, I need to just get into that. How would one imagine being on an all-boys team in the 80s as a girl and playing probably, were you competing mostly against boys or was it, or how do I imagine that happening?
There was one other girl that played. She played for Boston Spa High School, Nancy Ryan. Nancy, it was the next district south of us, actually. But there were just the two of us, and we played from the same tees. You learned how to, I think more than anything, you learned how to be responsible for yourself, be accountable for it all, but you learned how to score. Because, you know, we weren't as strong and as long as some of the guys. I had a lot of guys in our area went on to play Division I, Division II college golf. So we had some very good players come out of here, and you learned how to score, learned how to get the ball in the hole. And we played in some really lousy weather, which I think helped me in the long run as a player.
So
by the time I did get to the state championship in 83, it was 98 guys and me at Cornell. And I had the lead after 9 holes.
And you'd be teeing up next to them. You wouldn't be teeing up like girls nowadays tee up on the, you know, red or
no, there were no four
they get like 100 yards up the fairway, sorry, but you tee up right next to the guys.
Correct.
And you compete with them.
Correct.
That's impressive.
Yes, yeah,
some of them took the loss pretty
that's
hard.
Really impressive.
That's very cool. But maybe that's a good segue into how the game attracts new players. Well, it's not really the game that attracts new players. I mean, it's the golf courses, the clubs, the federations, et cetera, that are supposed to attract new players. And that brings us to growing the game, which is the biggest I don't know how I can say it, the biggest load of bull that's coming out of the LIV Tour, that they're doing it to grow the game.
Give me my brain back. I was just going to go there.
Oh, yeah. Please. Come on. Please go wherever you
baton.
Want.
I'm handing over the baton. Growing the game, I understand something completely different under growing the game. Growing the game is not going somewhere, taking a guaranteed check. Anyway, before I get too worked up, take me off the hook, please, Dottie.
Well, I think it's our duty as, you know, kind of stewards of the game to give people not reasons to grow the game, but to fall in love with the game and then want to share it. And I think that's what's not happening with LIV. If anything, I think LIV has continued the division that's across society today. And it's made enemies of former neighbors. And I think that's doing anything but what they were supposed to be doing. This is not growing the game. If anything, it's dividing it, and it's starting to divide a little bit players coming out of college, the young guns coming out looking toward the PGA Tour or toward the DP World Tour. It's cast a little bit of a pall. We don't know what's going to happen in the women's game for the LET and the LPGA Tour. And I think it's really, you know, you got players within the same communities in Georgia and South Carolina and Florida that are now on opposite sides of a very divisive, not growing subject.
Yeah, it's getting pretty ugly between the players. I mean, it's
and sadly, you know, we're getting ready. We have all of this excitement about the new year, a fresh start, a clean start. I mean, amazing venues for major championships, and you still need to be a bit of a lawyer in order to just talk about golf. So we sit and wait for the lawyers, and we sit and wait for people who are continuing to be deposed and who are going to go through more rounds of discovery and who are not going to be able to talk. And we wait for these little dribs and drabs to come out of leaked documents. And what are we going to do? We're going to have this going on until at least January of 24, when the American court case is going to be heard. And late into the spring, when the DP World Tour case will be heard. I think it's darn sad. I mean, there have been good things that have come of it. I mean, things that needed to be addressed by both tours. I believe firmly there are silver linings to everything. But the personal cost is really sad, and it's not growing the game.
We just opened our first Topgolf here in Germany, finally. the very first one, where another regular on our program, David Ogren, worked with one in San Antonio, I believe. That's growing the game, isn't it?
That's growing the game.
Yes. I mean, that I think is growing the game. Now, also, obviously, it's the job of the federations and the clubs and all these things. And we are here the second biggest. Well, we're probably the biggest golf federation in Germany with 700,000 golfers, Mark, something like that. Bigger than the Brits. But I think one thing that's also very important in growing the game, when we have the professional game and the amateur, the game that we play here, Mark and I mean, the technology, the advances of technology, and I heard you say something. I believe it was on the Golf Journal podcast that you did about the ball being dialed back. That there's some talk with the RNA and the USGA that that maybe there's something happening there where the ball will have more spin and it'll be back, you know, going the old way. What's happening there?
I think we're going to hear something. The USGA will have their annual meeting here in the next few weeks, and I think you'll hear bits and pieces come out of that. Really excited about the one particular, well, there have been some changes on that executive committee, but one particular person I think is going to prove to be quite powerful, and that's Jeff Sluman going onto that committee. And we've had some, you know, a former PGA champion been involved in the governance of the PGA Tour and the Senior Tour for a long time, well-respected. Yep. Well thought, well read, been all over the world and came up, you know, his experience was not spoon fed. It was playing for a college team that went defunct, playing all over immeasurably bad places, not even safe places to pursue his dreams. So it's not like you're getting a guy on there that's had a silver spoon of golf in his mouth since the time he picked up a club. I think you're going to see some needed and common sense sort of changes come out of that. I think you saw a little bit of that with the rules changes that started January 1st. Some of those were just common sense, and it took them a little while to shake it out after the big 2019 changes. Mm-hmm. But I think you're going to see ultimately a spinnier golf ball, that great shots are still going to be rewarded, but miss hits will be magnified the way they used to be. So it will make people think about, do I play bomb and gouge, or is that no longer feasible? Can I put it in a position where I just can't score if I'm trying to put a number on a scorecard? I think we're going to get back to potentially saying enough is enough with some of the distance. Whether that's by agronomic practice or whether that's truly by technology of the clubs that we're swinging. We can't take away the athletic changes that have been made. You can't say you can't go to the gym and you can't do this and you can't do that. But I think we can protect the upper echelon of the game, taking away the great places that we play. I mean, to have St. Andrews old course need to be stretched out over bits and pieces of five courses there in order to hold the Open. It's just, there's a little sadness there. Mm-hmm. So I think we're slowly going to see those things happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, there'll be some kicking and screaming and all that, but what do people do when they're faced with uncertainty or a changing baseline? They mm-hmm. figure it out.
Right.
It has happened before. You know, they have regulated clubs before, and there was a huge, you know, revolt in the industry, and it took about a week, and then everyone was building new drivers and trying to, you know, crawl back to where they were. The interesting thing, though, that you're saying, especially about the ball, is something that, Frank, you know a lot better than I do, that happened with tennis, is that they sort of regulated the ball for professional play. What's that going to do with the golf ball industry? Because, you know, we all know that most of these companies make most of their money with balls. You know, the amount of balls I lose and the amount of balls I find, you know, and I'm not the only one losing balls. And there's going to be, you know, some point where you're going to have to divide the top game from the amateur, or you're going to say, okay, these are, and will the industry be happy enough to say, okay, we're going to sell this really, really, really special ball just for professionals. It's going to spin out of the way. So that would mean me taking three off the tee every single time I tee up because I've got too much spin on the ball. Most amateurs won't be playing with that. And then, so it will change the face of the industry, and it will change advertising. It will bring back a lot of stuff that, you know, people have, you know, basically forgotten, won't it?
I think it's great. I mean, they're going to, you know, put another line on the ball plant. So we have to make the golf ball A and the golf ball B. And I remember going onto the PGA America board at the end of 2012. So I served from 13 through 15. And it was when they took away anchoring. It was my first board meeting when anchoring was announced. And everybody said, the long putters, nobody's going to be able to use long putters anymore. Well, no, that's not the rule. You just can't anchor it. Okay, people figured that out. But the thing that was still hanging out there was the golf ball. Was this just a test run for what they were going to maybe potentially do in the golf ball over the next decade or something? And I did ask that question. And I said, does this mean we're going through a time where we're going to talk about bifurcation? And the lid came off the place. What are we doing now? We're talking about bifurcation. Now, where we draw that line in the sand, that's above my pay grade. But I do believe that we have to do what we can do, everything we can do to continue to really embrace the good things that came out of COVID with golf.
Yeah.
That was a lot more people playing golf and not just playing all day. Go out and play three holes, just get outside, be out in a social manner, play six holes, play nine holes, play in a league, be social and active about what golf can bring while still protecting the traditions and some of the places that we play the game. I think there's a way to do that. Mm-hmm. And it's that B word. It's bifurcation.
I love that word.
I love it. And it's interesting, you know, because especially as you said, like the, you know, having the possibility to still give St. Andrews a chance to stand up against these pros, give Troon the chance. You know, they're, you can't. You've obviously said it. If you look at the 17th hole at St. Andrews, they're moving the tee box back and back and back. And it's basically in the middle of the driving range across the road. And it's, they're turning a course into something that a lot of us who have played the course and still love the course can hardly relate to, because when none of us is ever going to go back to that, you know, to that tee box and play the same course. So it might be a huge chance to preserve what's really good and to bring back some of the places that that couldn't be played or can't be played at the moment.
Right. And I think the other key word to maybe think about as we do potentially have these things happening, the term shot value. And yeah. I think that's what they were looking for when they did make the change at Augusta National at the 13th. Mm-hmm. Is to bring that shot value back. Do I have to contemplate what could or could not happen with this? And it you don't have to contemplate too much when you have an 8-iron or 9-iron in your hand. Mm-hmm. But when you're back there off a hanging lie and trying to thread the needle into the road hole at St. Andrews with a major championship on the line, and there's maybe a 4 or 5-iron in your hand, which was pretty common. Mm-hmm. When the design went
out,
you can talk all that bunker you want, but and how it has changed over the years. But the shot value of and the scare factor, maybe we're going to bring back a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. But you ought to have to think about it when it really matters.
But would it be? I mean, is it possible that there would be one ball for the pros and one ball for us?
I totally see that happening. Yes,
there'll be a tournament ball.
That's right.
It'll be called the tournament ball or whatever, and they're all going to get the specifics, and that is what they're going to have to build.
And they'll have a window that they have to work within.
Yeah,
and that's what it's going to be.
That would be something to look forward to, actually.
I think so.
I think so too.
Especially as a spectator, seeing people not only hitting balls for 300 and whatever yards, and then just chipping it onto the green.
I found a Spalding Molitor in my chag bag.
Remember that? And that ball was considered a rocket.
The rocket.
The rocket. Yes.
I remember that. And you brought up the 13th at Augusta, where you're going to be in just a couple of months, a few months. What do the players make of that? I mean, is that here's a stupid question. Why not just make it a par four and leave the tee where it is?
You could, but I think you go back to Bob Jones and Clifford Roberts and the intent of that. And by the way, great book that's available on the market. I don't, it might still be available new. It's called The Making of the Masters. And it talks about how that 13th hole was discovered, not created. And I really believe that shot value, that's the one.
It's David it's a Owen.
Beautiful book, David Owen.
David Owen, yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, one of our German guests, a writer, he said this is like one of the books that Stefan Meyerwein said one of the books you definitely have to read.
No doubt.
About the Masters. It's David Owen for everyone out there, and it is still available. Simon and Schuster. Sorry.
Yeah, it's you'll get a whole appreciation. I think. Ooh. Hey, you're growling for that. he likes it too. I always read it before I go back to the Masters every year. I think it gives you an appreciation for why things have remained the same at Augusta National. So that goes back to your question about why just not make it a par four instead of a five.
Mm-hmm.
I think it gives you a great background into Bob Jones' upbringing, Clifford Roberts' upbringing, what they went through just to make the Masters a success. Just really interesting things about the topography, about how it evolved as a place. And I really believe that Bob Jones wanting that second shot to be of consequence, something that you had to really mull over, is why they've kept the shot value. Mm-hmm. Similar as much as they possibly can. And I don't think people really can understand, unless you've been down into that corner, just how steep the turn is and the way moving that tee back is going to bring back in the shape of the land and having to actually get back to where it was. Bravo. I mean, if you hit the tee shot and get that thing running around the corner and get to a flattish lie, because it's the flattest lies are closest to that tributary of Rays Creek. If you can take that chance, then you ought to have an easier second shot. But if you're taking the conservative way off the tee, and a lot of times if you've had a front come in and you're going to get a north wind in your face, you're going to have to think about the consequence of a second or third shot.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I'm excited. I just love
it. Yeah, I think a lot of people are. Yeah. I've not seen it in person, but my... scouts on the ground say it's magnificent.
Right. Your scouts on the ground. She has boots on the ground everywhere, Mark.
She gets to go to the Masters every year. She gets to go to the Masters. She doesn't only have boots on the ground.
She paid for it. Yeah, okay, but she has boots on the ground now.
She gets to work
on the ground now.
Yeah.
I mean, when did you start being the walking reporter, which I think is a stupid name, walking reporter. You're so much more than that, a walking reporter.
Yeah.
The Augusta didn't allow it? Didn't allow anybody to walk?
All the announcers are in towers.
I mean, this was recently that they just allowed it, right?
November of 2020. It was a COVID change.
Really?
Because they were trying to spread people out, yes. And took it as a chance to do something a little bit different.
Right.
So instead of me, I typically was behind the 13th green in that tower. So I saw those those shots come into that green with an eight or nine iron, or whether it be a hybrid, or how the weather changed that hole so much. I also had the fourth hole. So I had those two holes, and for a while I did interviews. So last players would go through 13 and I would jump in a cart and get up to Butler Cabin or up to the locker room area as soon as I possibly could. So COVID changed a lot of things. And I think, again, silver linings, that was one of the things. I remember getting the phone call from my boss at the time, Lance Barrow, I had just come out of the Pilates studio, so it was early October of 2020. And he said, give me a call back when you can take this call, but I'd like to get your input about whether you'd be interested in actually walking at Augusta this year instead of being in a tower. So I said, there's one word, yes. I'm going to hang up and call you back because I'm now doing 2 days with Pilates and back to going into cardio. So I worked my tail off to get ready for that because it is the hardest.
It's a tough walk, isn't it?
Without a question. Yeah. And you're carrying a monitor.
Yeah.
Plus the usual microphone and the transponder and the radio and all of that. So it gave me something really cool to look forward to. And I'm just tickled pink that I've managed to keep my job so far.
Is it true that Tiger said when he saw you walking the course, what are you doing here?
So if you recall the first round of the Thursday 2020 was delayed because of a really wicked storm that rolled through. Mm-hmm. So I was originally assigned to go with Dustin Johnson, but because of the tee times being pushed back, I think it was 3 hours or so. I ended up going, as we came on the air, Tiger was on the second nine. So I picked his group up in the middle of the 13th fairway, watched him play 13, and I cut across up the hill onto 14, let him pass by me, and he stopped dead in his tracks. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, it's so 2020, isn't it? And he just started laughing because it was one of the cool things that came out of all the sadness that we all went through. We got better at a lot of things we do.
Just a question. Was that an idea that the network came up with? Or was it Augusta who said that?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Taking credit for that would be something fine, wouldn't it? You know, you could say, it was our idea.
I don't have any idea.
That's nice.
They're going with the
I was happy to say yes, though.
They're going with the times. Mr. Horner, QN.
Shall we really? Well, the good thing is that we've already touched a few of the topics that would be in the quick nine. Frank, thank you very much. I should actually give you the questions I'm planning to ask before I ask them.
You know what?
They basically, you know, eliminated half of them, but that's how it works. Dotty, quick nine, never quick, never nine. Answer whatever you'd like to. Out of all the great advice Mr. Polvert shared, what's the most valuable golf tip you've ever been given?
To never give up, because you never know when success may come darting at you. And what did we learn yesterday watching the Century Tournament of Champions? Right?
God.
Who would have
that was some golf, wasn't it?
That was it in a nutshell right there. John Rahm is 9 shots behind Colin Morikawa. After starting out with bogey, and Morikawa makes 3 at the first, and Rahm's holding the trophy at the end of the day.
It's golf, only in golf.
That's sports competition. That's everything.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay, Dotty, you are going to die. You know that.
None of us are getting out of here alive.
but not today. So, but who will you play?
I hope not.
Sorry, that wasn't. You know, it worked better on Rick Riley, actually. Sorry. who will you play your last round with?
Wow. Okay. So I've been asked this question just if you had one round left to play. So I guess it's the same thing. So it would be with my dad, Seve, and Winston Churchill.
The guy with the ruined walk.
That guy.
Yeah. it's an interesting thing. A lot of people just connect Winston Churchill to that ruined walk thing. But a lot of people don't know how sporty he was in his young years. You know, he was the charge of the Light Brigade. Mm-hmm. He was a massive rider. And I think he was quite a golf person too.
I think, you can talk all you want about Churchill as maybe co-architect of saving Western humanity during World War II, but I also think you realize how beat down he was at times politically, and just he couldn't spell defeat. And I just greatly admire. I wish I'd had a chance to meet him. He passed the year I was born.
He couldn't spell defeat and got a Nobel Prize in Literature.
How about that?
That is great. Okay. What would you be if you hadn't decided to dedicate your life to golf? I know this is a standard question, but I'm sure our audience is really interested in finding out.
So I have two things, and they're very dissimilar. I always wanted to be a ski bum. Just head to the hills and be there for a while.
Just live in a hut.
Yeah, you know, I taught skiing as a junior. It's in my family. My family's 70 plus years in the ski industry with a retail store here in Saratoga Springs, and it's certainly in my blood. I've skied before I played golf, but I gave myself 3 years when I decided to pursue professional golf coming out of college to make it or break it. And the break it, if I didn't get my tour card, was to become a pilot. So that would have been my B.
Well, there you go. Pilot.
You know, your B plan was one of the dreams most young men have, or young boys have, at least between, you know.
What kind of planes would we be flying?
I would have flown commercially.
And the big ones.
Flying to
this is Captain Pepper.
That's right. I was never smart enough to be a doctor, so a captain's going to have to fit.
Have you done a lot of talking about flying and skiing? Have you done a lot of skiing in Europe?
I have not. My family takes through the ski shop a group to Europe every year, and I've, because of my golf schedule, never been able to go. So when I'm not doing this in February for CBS some year, I'm going to make that trip.
Well, give us a call. We'll come down and watch.
I love that.
Yeah, we got no knees left here between the two of us.
Not my knees anymore. Okay. Now, this is one of our favorites, okay? So you've won, sorry to say, the senior club championship at your club.
I have not. But
you have. Just imagine you have. Okay.
Oh, imagine I have.
Okay. Yeah. As unlikely it may seem, okay? I just didn't want to be rude. You and your friends decide to celebrate at a karaoke club. What's the first song you'll sing, and how are you going to close the night?
I'm going to sing. Here's something you flushed out of me. I was once a groupie with Rod Stewart.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So it's going to be the song that was in my head when I won the Dyna in 99. It was in my head all week, and that was Hot Legs.
Wow.
Sorry.
All week.
All right, we're going to finish up. I'm going to have to come back to that one. I'm going to write that down.
We've had so far.
On the Dyna, humming Hot Legs.
Hot Legs.
And that's the opening number. Oh, my God.
That's right.
Where's this going to lead us?
I don't know about the closing number. My God, how do you close the night?
Well, mostly drunken.
Probably. A little Advil might help. But, yeah, I was... that 98, 99, 2000, if there was a Rod Stewart concert within 2 hours of an LPGA event, I was there. I had a backstage pass for the season that he had given me. And I even sat in the audio box one year. He came to Saratoga, came to my hometown. Met my aunt and uncle. I sat in the audio box with the technicians, watched the show. It was phenomenal.
So wow. You'd probably be singing I Am Sailing just to end.
That's right. That's good.
There you go.
Right. Okay. Right. Did you notice that answer came? You know, how
the Roderick, you know, Roderick is still out there.
That's right. He is.
Yeah. Is he doing Vegas or something?
I think he does have a standing gig coming up in Vegas, but sadly he buried, like, I think two of his three brothers in the last.
Yeah, there's loads of drama
last
around.
It's been bad.
Yeah. Golf has changed since you've started playing. There's surely great things, but probably a lot of bad stuff. What, if you could turn back time, would you reverse or undo?
Ooh. What I undo. Personally, I wouldn't have been in a great rush to put inferior graphite shafts in my driver. I would have waited until either I was talked some sense into about just putting lightweight steel in, but I thought, well, I'm going to hit it farther. I'm going to do anything I can to try to hit it farther. For me, it was poor technology and graphite, but when I got it right, it was great.
Yeah.
Daiwa came out with a phenomenal shaft that was wrapped in Kevlar in the early 90s. That was, you'd take a set of 100 of them and spin out 10 perfect ones, 20 perfect ones, 30 perfect ones, 40. They were so consistent. But for me, it was a mistake to have not waited till the proper graphite came out.
Hmm. So did it ruin some of your rounds? Did it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you'd be going like, what am I doing here?
Mm-hmm. That was early 80s.
Let's get back to technology later. That's an interesting thing. Some very quick ones. Your favorite major?
Mark, you.
Very quick ones.
Favorite major. That was a quick one. It would have to be the Masters.
I thought so, actually. Beer on the course?
From on the course, for sure.
No. Do you drink beer on the course?
Oh, God, no. I turn into Gumby if I've had anything to drink on the golf course.
I can hardly swing a golf club. I can't drink and drive, no.
No, it's awful.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Music on the range?
Always.
What do you listen to?
Well, I already answered that question.
All right. Do you drive or walk?
Oh, walk.
Dog likes it a lot better, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think the timing of the round, appreciation of architecture, the whole thing is put your feet on the ground.
If you could only play one more course for the rest of your life, even if you're going to end up being 99, what course would it be?
Salem Country Club on the North Shore of Boston. Donald Ross Gem and the site of Babe Harris's great win after she came back from cancer to win. And I think she had a colostomy bag when she won there in 54.
I remember seeing that in the Founders movie, I believe it was.
Yeah,
she passed. That is something we should actually strongly...
Yeah,
advise every listener to watch. It's free on YouTube. You can watch it on YouTube. It's a great documentary.
And kudos to Kari Webb because she put up quite a bit of cash to actually fund that.
Kudos.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes dream of golf?
And oh my God, no, they're nightmares.
great, because that's what we're looking for. and if there are. And if you do dream of golf, mm-hmm. what are your dreams?
They were the same ones every year as the season started to get closer and closer. And the first one is that I'm standing on a tee box and it doesn't matter where I put the ball in the teeing ground. There is a limb that I cannot take a backswing. The tree just keeps moving. I can't take it back.
So it wasn't you. It was basically a moving tree around you. It's like
it was an obstacle a wall from the outside. Yes. The second one is that I get a golf ball, and I'll take some evaluation of this at some point. I get a golf ball stuck in a filing cabinet, and I cannot get it out.
What? I'm sorry. But that's terrible, isn't it?
Nancy Lopez tells me she used to have the same one. So what's that tell you? I mean,
wow.
Isn't that wild?
Wow.
It is.
Now, I don't have those as much anymore. Now I get to a golf course and I'm late and I can't find the RF truck to get my equipment and on the air.
You're there without a microphone or something.
Yep.
Wow.
It's always about performance, isn't it?
I think that's my favorite question now. Dreaming one.
It's not, yeah, those are not dreams. Those are nightmares.
It used to be the karaoke one, but now it's the dreaming one.
Thank you very much. Because and you're not alone. You're not alone because no, we're not. But thank you for this answer because you're not alone. A lot of our guests have shared nightmares, so you're not alone. You know, Ben Crenshaw talked about not being alone. But Bernhard Langer, well, we all know Bernhard's nightmare, and the putting and so. But that was very insightful. Thank you. And working on course for the media, you've seen loads of fantastic golf. What's the best golf you've ever witnessed? One singular round, you'd say, like, this was the most fantastic I've ever witnessed. Could even be your own.
No.
It could.
No. I walked with Dustin Johnson the weekend. He went bloody ballistic at in Boston at the FedEx Cup playoffs a couple of years ago. And I don't know, what did he shoot? 30 some odd under par. That's good golf. But I think after Tiger won his last Masters, his opening round in defense was one of the cleanest rounds of golf. It was a round of 68. So this is, I mean, it's not like we're threatening to bust sub 60. But yeah. As far as pure ball striking and giving yourself an opportunity at just about every corner, it was a painting. It was just absolutely a work of art, and it could have been 62. It could have been really something special. But to watch somebody clearly in command, and it was almost like he had the golf ball on a joystick. Just boom, 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 boom there. It was terrific.
Mm. Poetry in motion.
Very much so. Yeah.
Whilst your book gives great insights into how you became a player, still there's always this one question, the answer to which can change, evolve, turn itself inside out. Is why do you love this silly, old, stuffy game, golf?
Because you're never going to perfect it, but you're always going to have a competition.
Thank
and
you
whether
very
that's
much.
Competition against the golf course, an opponent, or yourself, there's always going to be competition.
That's a great answer. Those were the quick nine.
Yeah, they were. That wasn't so bad, was it?
No.
It doesn't hurt. Usually it doesn't hurt.
Let's
get the occasional laugh once in a while.
I think you're all still laughing about Rod Stewart.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, actually not, because I grew up in England in the 70s and Rod Stewart was the thing. He was the thing. And I Am Sailing is something that sneaks up on me once in a while. And yeah. I sort of go like, this can't be in your head, can it? You really are not singing a Rod Stewart song inside of your head. You're like, you're a grown man. Stop it. So I can completely relate.
No apologies.
But you were humming or whatever while you were playing. I mean,
I can still see that. So ABC had the coverage, and I think I hold out Saturday at 9 for Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see if you watch the gate, it's perfectly in tune. It is in lockstep with Hot Legs.
Wow. I got to do that because there's a guy, John Novosel, who wrote this book, Tour Tempo. I don't know, you know, and he's like, he's talking about such that everybody has their own rhythm when they swing. You should listen to a song that's in the same rhythm as your swing on the way to the golf course. And a swing set through is, I think, is the three words that he's using. And I don't know, but Hot Legs, I got to check that out.
You've put me on track for one last one. No, in the quick nine. I'm sorry, but it's because because what I imagine now is probably one of the best moments you've had on a golf course with your favorite song in your head, in command of what you're doing with yourself and winning. What's the worst moment you can remember you suffered on a golf course?
Hmm. Well, I know my greatest. I always put too much pressure on myself to try to win a women's open. So that was, you know, that was certainly a disappointment. And I had my fair share of cracks at it.
Yeah.
But growing up where I grew up, where I still live, the tournament in Rochester was almost like a fifth major for me. And I had won there in 96 after I had played so poor. I mean, I was a legitimate slump for the first half of the 1996 season for me. I withdrew from two tournaments, went home. I was living in South Carolina at the time, and just hit balls until my hands bled and walked the golf course, lived on a very hilly part of the state, and did 2-a-days. And I literally found it in the dirt with bloody hands and pulled out from those tournaments. Went back by starting to play in Kathy Kratzert's fundraiser in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and shot 66. And I thought, well, it's only pro-am, but we're definitely on a better track. And then promptly went to Rochester and won the tournament the next week. I won 4 of my next 7 starts. But coming back to Rochester the following year, defending, I was tied for the lead, had a putt from about 2, it was no more than 2 feet, probably a little less than 2 feet for par at the last hole, descended to a playoff with Penny Hamill and missed. That one hurt a lot. Just because it had been such a turnaround from where I'd been the year before.
Yeah.
And what was really a tournament that I always had kept a strong eye on, and still had so many, you know, strong ties to Rochester itself. That one hurt a lot.
Whoa. I miss a lot of 2 foot. So, you know.
Yeah, but that was when you shouldn't ever. I mean, uphill right edge, just.
It's impossible. Well, it would have been impossible to miss. I can see it, and we can hear it.
As long as you don't dream about it, it's okay.
I haven't. So what's that tell you? It still stings, but it doesn't come up in a nightmare.
Let's talk a little bit about letters to a future champion.
Sure.
I checked it out as an audiobook here on Audible. In Germany, it's not on Amazon. Well, before we talk about the book, let's first talk about where we can buy it, because
sure.
My dear co-host and co-conspirator Mark Horner, who is an author and a writer himself, he once said qualitative words should be on paper or something like that. What did you say? I don't even remember.
Oh, I can't remember. Oh, but it's probably some snobbish crap. But yeah,
it was because he's right. It, you know, good stuff must be on paper. I mean, the audiobook is cool. Where can we buy this book?
So, fortunately, I'm the distributor. So, in order to get this done, what I wanted it done, and do it the way that Mr. Pulver, I believe, would have wanted it done. I self-published, and so I fill all the orders through my own website, dottypepper.net. So everything that comes through, I put my hands on to send back out to customers. I'll have to bring it to Europe for you otherwise, because the postage is brutal. That's where the audiobook really has become most valuable, because of just the way we decided to do the business plan.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Oh, sorry.
No, it was... It was interesting doing the audiobook, because I had to find someone that it sounded like Mr. Pulver to me. So, because you could hear his voice through the letters that I kept, you can certainly hear my voice through the letters that I wrote him, but I thought it was important to be able to have his experienced voice and the cadence and the pitch be someone that reminded me of him. And we fortunately did find a man in Pittsburgh that was tremendous. And it was a really great experience doing all of it. Stressful, I would say. And in some ways more stressful than actually writing the book itself, because my editor kind of took the shackles off me in June or July of 2020, when we really got into the nuts and bolts. A lot, and it was It was a really cathartic time to do that. But it also, when he said, "Dottie, don't try to be too perfect," which you hear through the book, just write it all down. We can always edit. Just put it all down, whether you like it, whether you don't, whether you cry, whether you laugh, put it all down and we'll go back through it. And that was, it was free sailing from there on in.
How was it to read your own book, to give your own writing a voice?
I still can't believe we finished it, first of all. And to have done it when we did it, it was exhausting. It was really fulfilling, but it was exhausting because it took you back through the emotions of, you know, as a teenager, you're going through all these developmental things and the relationship with your parents and relationship with your sister and going through the college process and knowing some of the things that happened behind the scenes and the emotions that were behind them. It all got dredged right up again. And some of it was pretty raw. But I think I continued to learn a lot about how I learn, how much deeper the relationship was with Mr. Pulver than I perhaps even knew it was then, because it's been a relationship with their entire family that has stuck around since. I mean, there's still one of his children left, and we correspond on a regular basis. And now his grandchildren.
Is it something? Can you compare your relationship with him or the, his who he was, kind of like a Harvey Penick, person?
You took the words right from me, and that's why I had Kathy Whitworth, who we just lost on Christmas Eve, why I had her do the portion of the book that she did, because she had that relation with Harvey. And I also had a relationship with her as my first Solheim Cup captain, as someone I played against, played for, and learned from. But I also, to this day, I don't think she's gotten enough credit for the number of wins and the impact of her career. So I wanted, in my small way through my book, to be able to give her a space, so maybe people will talk about her just a little bit more, a little bit louder.
Mm. Mark, what was your, you said some powerful stuff to me today. I don't know if you want to share it, what you have to say about Mr. Pulver's letters. By the way, you know, Pepper and Pulver is the German word for powder. So if you put into German Google Pepper and Pulver, you get all kinds of very interesting exotic pepper mixtures.
Interesting. That's very interesting.
It's really spicy, isn't it?
Nice going, Mark.
I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry about the telephone again, Frank. Shouldn't have.
What happened? I didn't even hear.
There's something that I really took me whilst listening, and I really enjoyed that, listening to your writing, listening to you reading your writing, because there is a dimension extra. I like reading, you know, because it's like this weird drug-like trip you take looking at signs on paper, and then you hallucinate your way into someone else's head. But I really like being led through literature by, you know, especially if it's the writer. There was something that really, really struck me in his writing that was weird, because it's so other timely. It's so different to what, to how we communicate nowadays, how we talk to each other, how we write to each other. Yeah. It is a bit of a trip into another time. And it's more than just like a golf pro. It's like a mentor speaking. He's much, much more. And he is so, there's so much respect and politeness in how he speaks, how he writes, how he formulates, how he gives your parents his regards, how he, you know, how he talks himself down most of the time, how he how he believes that you're over-evaluating his role in your life. And it's something that you hardly ever see nowadays anymore. It's someone who's, you know, not full of himself. He's, you know, and he's generally, there's this general kindness and respect in everything he's written that really took me. And I must admit, it did nearly make me cry once or twice, because there's something in this mentorship that you don't really find easily. And right. And you'd wish it for everyone. You know, you'd wish everyone to have this experience, to have someone who will, you know, talk you down when you're too far. We'll right. tell you to slow down if you're too quick. We'll tell you to hurry up if you're too slow. We'll just end most of his correspondence with no answer is required, or no reply is required. Which struck me as something completely out of this world today, because, you know, we always write and then, why don't you answer my emails? Why didn't you answer my WhatsApp? Why is it taking you 2 days to answer? And there's this gentle person going, no answer required after I've told you what you should do for the next half year. You don't bother to answer. You know, I know that you've received that. And that was something, there's a quality in this book. I'm turning around in circles. I'm sorry, but that is something that really it does. There's something in there that makes it a very, very, very important read for me.
Well, that was turning in circles. That was what the editor, myself, I turned myself inside out to write this. He's trying to absorb this, and then the designer of the book. Was going in those same circles, trying to format the letters and the order of them in a proper way. But I think the thing that struck everybody, as it struck you, was that there was a formality to his writing. He was a cub writer at the Saratogian when he came out of Albany Business School before he went completely into the golf business. But he was also a well-read, not just golf, but everywhere, whether it was philosophy, whether it was politics, whatever it was, he was extremely well-read. And I think that comes through his letters too, that there's not a singular focus, but there's also, while he was extremely intelligent, there's also a humility. You would have never known that he was one of the founders of this section of the PGA, Northeastern New York PGA section. I mean, he was golf royalty in this part of the United States, that he took down the national PGA champion, Tom Creevy, when he was still national champion. And to have, the self-deprecation comes through at every opportunity.
Yeah.
he really needles himself pretty well, but he was a mentor. In every sense of the word. And it wasn't just about golf. It was about making sure I had an education, that plan B, about managing a schedule and setting goals and knowing when to back off. You've been in the cauldron, as he liked to talk about it, too long. There's one of the letters that talks about you haven't suffered any physical injuries, but mentally you need a break.
Yeah.
So there are those sorts of things that he was... I guess if you had to put a big old label on him today, yeah, he'd be a mentor, but he's almost like a life coach that just happened to teach golf.
I think that's one of the qualities that I've read out of it or heard out of it. And there's this one thing that I really, really liked hearing, because you don't really hear that a lot. It's like, if you get bored with this game, you know, just let it be for a few hours or a few days or until it spikes you. It's okay. You know, you don't have to stand there every day in the grind and do it and do it and do it again. But if there's something else that is more interesting at that moment, just do that. You'll get back to the game if you want to get back to the game, if the game needs it. And there's something else that I thought was really interesting. If you're going on tour, I don't know if I can... But something like if you're planning on going on tour, make sure that you can beat every single golfer in 300 miles from your home at least 5 out of 6 times or 4 out of 5 times, something like that. The tour would be very small if everyone was saying that.
That kind of flies in the face of Major League Baseball expanding and NFL going to deeper games and more cities and all of that. But it was something my dad told me as well, because, you know, he was without question the best player in the state of New York in 1962. But he said that makes me one of 50. So it's not a downer. It's just reality.
Yeah.
And now, because of the international scope of American baseball, it's not even just in the United States. It's kind of, you know, the Dominican Republic and wherever else within Latin America that baseball is such an accelerator for players to move and live out their dreams. But you're one of a lot of a very big pool of talent. Yeah. But he was realistic about that. But he noticed also in all of the letters, there's always something positive at the very end. Always.
It's very uplifting.
Yeah.
Most of it's very uplifting. Yeah.
That was an excellent review, Mr. Horan. He's pretty good, isn't he?
He's way good.
it'll get a very nice review when it.
Well, I
get a signed copy.
I have the audiobook.
Well, if you guys send me your address, I will make
sure. I will.
There you go. What's on your schedule now, Dottie, until you start going out there again? Obviously, the big one coming up is the Masters, but what do you do now?
So I have started to make my list to be prepared, as Mr. Pulver talked about it, to make sure I don't leave anything behind for 4 weeks on the West Coast. So I will leave on the 22nd, and we'll make our way to the West Coast. We set up base in Palm Springs, so that I'm not going back and forth. My dog.
Rupert.
Well, the post lady rang the doorbell, so that's why he heard that. He is a schnauzer after all. So we'll set up base on the West Coast in Palm Springs for 4 weeks in a friend's guest house, so that I don't have to come back and forth across the country for each of those.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be out there from the 22nd of January until the 20th of February, and then come home and hopefully ski a few days and get into the process of being prepared for the Masters.
Right. Yeah. You know, last year's Master, one of our favorite things was, and we did a special on it, was how Hideki tried to help Scotty Scheffler into the jacket in Butler cabin. Yeah. Oh, my God. It was priceless.
Priceless.
It was priceless. Well, you're the first one we're talking about
this. Jim Nance did it. Faldo's gone. Sir Nick retired.
Is retired. We have new face in the 18th tower in Trevor Immelman.
Masters champion.
Masters champion. We get Colt Knost just about every week this year. We have Mark Immelman every week this year. So we are in a consistent flow with our voices, and I think our pattern will continue to develop and get better. Frank and Ian are in their usual spots at 16 and 17. And on we go. We do the playoffs this year, which is something we have not done all the way through ever. So new spots for us in Chicago and Atlanta at the end of the season.
Right. Looking
forward to that.
CBS doing the Rider or the Solheim? No. Huh?
Neither. No, those are both NBC properties, Comcast properties. So that will not be on our radar. Interesting, those are back-to-back if I'm not mistaken.
Italy, and so I don't know which one
comes I think Spain for the women and then Italy for the men. I think they're back to back, and then they'll split again first time it changed because of 9/11, and now post COVID they'll go back and make the adjustments not the same year again.
Well, we've won the 4 out of the last 6 Solheim Cups. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
I'm well aware.
Well aware. Okay. You're going to take it back in Spain?
Well, I think if Stacey Lewis has anything to say about it, she will. But there are an awful lot of – I mean, the depth of the European team is something that I don't think there's been that much depth in a long time.
Right. Yeah. It's really fantastic. I mean, it's a shame that it doesn't get enough media attention. The women's game. I think we have one LET event here in Germany. Right. You know, there's that big big Aramco event where the prize money is like 10 times what it normally is. We had Liz Young on, who was the player director for the LET.
Yes.
And she had some strong opinions about that as well. It was very interesting. What's your relationship with the players when you walk there on the men's tour? I mean, you mentioned that brief thing with Tiger. You spend the whole day with them. Yep. Is their caddy flashing you the sign? Is there a spotter in between? How does that work?
So my relationship, I try not to. So I have a way to get a hold of Tiger, but I don't have his number. I try to keep it super professional with all these guys, and just know that I have a great deal of respect for what they're doing, because I did it, and I did it well for a while. And there were other times that I was pretty bad at it. So I appreciate good golf and bad golf, and try to just talk about golf as I see it, as I knew it, as I still know it. And I think most of the time they appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But I do try. I'll most times go to the range before the round starts, so I will have seen them or at least made contact with the caddy. Or if there's a player that wants to share something, I'll let them share. But I'll never ever interrupt a player during practice session or a warm up session, because I just believe that's hallowed time. And on course interviews, I find very awkward. I just believe that that's their office, and if they want to tell us something, my relationship is good enough that they're going to tell it, and I'll be able to relay it. But if not, that's their office, and I really respect that. Mm-hmm. So as far as getting the clubs, they generally come from the caddy. Sometimes it comes to me, but sometimes I'm looking to get another, or make sure I'm not in someone else's way. I have a phenomenal spotter that works with me, and he's in there all the time, and he'll get that sign and send it to me. Mm-hmm. But I've had the same guy now for, this will be year 8. So we did that November 2020 Masters together. So we were the only ones inside the ropes. And I will tell you that the couple of rounds, the practice rounds, figuring out where we could go, where we could get the information we needed to get and not be seen on camera was a task, because I don't like being seen. Like to be able to get in and get out. And that was a hard thing when you can't back up to patrons or spectators. There was nowhere to hide. So we were really working hard, Wayne and I, to find that sort of sweet spot of being able to get information from the players and then be able to get out of camera shots.
Yeah. And then you walk around with like a yardage book. I mean, like, you know, that you... Mm-hmm. Almost like you're playing the golf course.
Exactly the way. I walk a golf course at the beginning of the week as I would as a player. So I mm-hmm. save all my yardage books from the previous years. I'll make changes to them if they've tweaked a bunker here or a tee angle here, or they've a different preparation here. It might have been closely mown here last year and it's not this. I have record of all of that. So I look at it as I did as a player. And that was advice that came to me for my first network producer, Tommy Roy. And he said, I want you to remember two things. I hired you because you know the game of golf. So I want you to talk about it as you know the game of golf. And he said, number two, the microphone doesn't know whether you're male or female. So just talk about what you know. So I was very, very fortunate to have him as my first network producer. And that was think about a rookie coming out with, I didn't know much about television.
Right.
Knew about golf. Yeah. And he wanted people who knew about golf, because you can teach them television.
Right.
It's hard to teach television to people who don't, or teach golf to people who don't, the other way around.
Right. I mean, the trick to make it, to put the average Joe on his couch into the situation of what's going on. And you know, I think that's the talent. And I think Bones did it very well for NBC. I mean, he's got that experience. I don't know what kind of player he is, but he saw enough golf with Mickelson. I think it's that's definitely the trick. And you're fantastic. I mean, we have we watch golf here on Sky.
Yes.
And it's Sky Germany, and our guy who's going to be on actually next week again, Gregor Biernat, who is our, he's alone commentating, and he sits in a basement in Munich. So it's difficult for him to put us there into the middle of the fairway and think what and see what they think and that kind of stuff. But I like the way, you know, all these people and going back to the 80s when you watch these people commentating. Now you said Trevor Immelman comes along. All these guys, the new guys that come, they stick around for 20 years. It's not like they're gone after a few years. You know, every couple of decades, they bring in some new blood and they stick around.
There's been a lot of change at NBC. But I think if you go back over the last, so I started with CBS in 2016. There's been a lot of change at CBS too over the time, but you're right. If you get one of those seats, you don't give it up quickly. So when I started in 2016, it was Peter Costas and Gary McCord. McCord's at 17, or I'm sorry, was at 16, and Costas on the ground with me. You had Ian Baker Finch at 17, but you didn't have Frank Nobilo yet, not full time. And you had Faldo in the lead analyst seat. And now, so Finchie's lasted longer than I have. I'm second in line behind Ian Baker Finch as an analyst. So there's been a lot of change at our little network as well.
Who would have thought that Faldo was such a funny guy, you know, because when you saw him playing, he's like this machine, but he is so funny.
Well, you would have never known the same thing of Pat Bradley. So when Pat was churning away, knocking out points to get into the World Golf Hall of Fame, and that was the only thing on her radar, there was no greater competitor. I mean, you talk about Ray Floyd, and I put Pat Bradley right there with him. But when Pat finally got in, I was actually in the grouping the day she qualified, the day she got her last win that qualified her for the Hall of Fame.
27 points, and, right?
Yes. So it was Brandi Burton, myself, and Pat in the last grouping in Southern California. Par 5, last hole, dogleg left. And I look behind, and all I can see is this poof of smoke. I mean, I think she smoked 3 cigarettes going up the last hole. She was so nervous, and she got into the scoring tent and she started crying. And she said, "Pards, I hope they let me in." And I said, "They're not letting me in. You're in. You won." And she always called you pro. But she was as hardcore a competitor as you could ever imagine. And the minute she got in, the next week she was a completely different person, and you saw a funny side of, and a very self-deprecating side to Pat Bradley.
There you go. Will we see you in Europe for the Open this year?
I don't know yet. I will definitely be at the Scottish.
Right.
It's on the CBS schedule again, and looking forward to that. We love going back to Gullen, and particularly at Muirfield. I'm very, very partial. You're going to see I actually just came up on my phone. The UK golf guy asked me to do my top 10. So I think you guys will be interested to see what I put in there. Ooh, we talked about Salem already, but you're going to see Muirfield in there.
Excuse me, Mr. Horner. He is a member up there in a couple of those places.
Not in Muirfield. No.
Not in Muirfield, but I think Panmure will do.
Well, Panmure's good.
You know, that's a that
trail's great. Lovely, but it's a fantastic place to go, and it's where golf comes from, and where it's still, you know, it still exists in a way that you can hardly find it probably in America, or you can hardly find it in Europe the way it exists there. It's always great to be there because it's so different, it's so down to earth, it's so real. You can take your dog.
You can take your dog. And one of the things I love about, you know, going from North Berwick to Gullen over to Aberlady is you see kids on their bicycles with their golf clubs over their shoulders. And it's just a magical stretch of golf. The golf land, links land, it's just beautiful. And yes, dogs are welcome.
Let's try to meet up there next year.
I would love that.
Or on the ski slopes. We'll wax your skis.
Oh boy. Now I'm afraid. There's another nightmare.
There you go. Well,
there's this Scotty's German American waxing my skis in my dreams.
Well, one each. I can't do both.
Fantastic. Pick one.
We'll do one. Go sit in your Aston Martin for a half an hour.
I'm gonna go take the beast for a ride, I think. And yeah. I might even put a little Rod Stewart on the radio.
What a way to make it a round thing. Dottie, thank you so much for taking the time, spending it with us. It was an absolute blast. Nothing short, everything and more that I expected and hoped for. Yeah, we wish you a great year.
Thank you.
And please check out that book in Germany if you're in Europe on the Audible or the audiobook, you can get it. If you're in the States, dottiepepper.net, I believe it is.
And send me your address so I can send you copies.
And it'll be packed by Dottie personally, as far as I understand.
Personally.
There you go. With love.
So great.
And Rupert supervises.
And Rupert too. Rupert goes downstairs to the basement where they're all stored every time.
There you go. Dottie, have a great year. We'll be listening for you.
Thank you all. I will look forward to the Scottish.
Be well. Thank you. Sure. I'm Frank Forster.
I'm Mark Hoener. To the Linksland.
To the Linksland.